Chapter 31. Paris, September 1986. Oliver and I took the ferry from Ajaccio to Nice. We'd each booked a small cabin, but I knew instantly that I would not be able to sleep. There was too much to think about. Instead, I told him that I planned to remain for a while up on the deck, and he opted to join me. The clouds that had obscured the sky had finally retreated in the afternoon to reveal a night sky of almost perfect clarity. We found a part of the deck that we could make our own, and sat and stared out across the depths towards the lights of the island, receding until they became tiny pinpricks of light, will-o'-the-wisps, lanterns, scarcely real. "I pack these," Oliver said, "just in case." He produced two beers from the battered rucksack he had brought, the only luggage he seemed to be taking with him. I thanked him as he passed me one, and he gave me a quick smile, then looked back out to sea. I wish that things could be simple between us, now that we had shaken off hostility, then strained formality, all of that. Instead, there was this other complicating element. I was sure I had not imagined the way he had looked at me in the boat the evening before, yet the idea of acknowledging it, of forcing it to reveal itself, was unthinkable. Now, removed from the island and from Stafford, our aloneness together felt dangerous. Though the boat was crowded with passengers, sitting there in the dark alcove we had found, suspended between the sea and sky, I could believe that we were the only people for miles around. "I was thinking," Oliver said then, surprising me. "I was always so depressed on this journey, back to the mainland, that I never realized how beautiful it is.
But coming the other way must have been the opposite."
"I was generally too excited then to notice."
He took a sip of his beer.
"Mum always hated taking the ferry. She once told me that she thought of it as the passage across the River Styx."
I tried to imagine how someone might equate the crossing to Corsica, land of light and sea, with a voyage into the underworld.
"For her sake," he said, "I hope that it wasn't where she ended up when she died. She'd have hated that, having spent her whole life trying to get away from it."
I cleared my throat. "How did she die?" Oliver didn't answer immediately, and my question seemed to echo in the silence. Immediately, I felt I had gone too far. But then he said quietly,
"An overdose."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
"Don't be. It happened a long time ago."
"How old were you?"
"It was the day after I'd turned 10, actually," he said, his tone slightly too offhand to be truly convincing. "Mum had this idea that I was now grown up. She'd allowed me to come to Cannes for the week, and that we should celebrate in style. It was the most bizarre day you can imagine. I feel sorry for her now, when I think about it. She simply didn't have a clue how to be a parent, even though she'd had such a good example from my grandmother."
He shrugged.
"It wasn't in her nature, I suppose. She told me that since I was now an adult, we'd have a grown-up celebration and go for lunch in the best restaurant. I'd have preferred a cake on the beach, to be honest. Most 10-year-old boys would, probably. Still, she was trying, and I suppose she didn't know what 10-year-old boys liked. It was out of town, the restaurant, about half an hour's drive away. My mother told me on the way that it was the place to go. Everyone who was anyone would be there. That didn't mean much to me, but she looked very elegant, and I was proud of her when we walked in and people turned to stare. I think she at least seemed like the somebody she wanted to be."
I remembered, as he said this, walking into the smoke-fugged bar of the Groucho Club with Mum, me only as high as her waist at the time, people swarming around her, patting me on the head. There were other beautiful women there, but she was by far the most beautiful, the most interesting, the most talented. I knew this unequivocally. She'd knelt and whispered in my ear, "We can go as soon as you want to. Tell me when, and we'll leave that very minute." "Did you enjoy it?" I asked.
"In a way. It was a new experience, certainly. It was a hot day, but inside the restaurant there was this strange refrigerated cool. You know the sort of place, huge white napkins folded into elaborate shapes, waiters like penguins. A bit old-fashioned now."
I nodded. He was speaking quickly, as if afraid of stopping, of not getting to the end. I wondered why he had chosen this moment to tell me. Perhaps I thought it was to do with the unusual confessional quality of our spot, the silence and darkness around us, like a cloak. "Maman ordered us champagne," he continued, "which I hated, but drank because I didn't want to look like a child. She kept leaning over and whispering to me, 'There's so-and-so, there's so-and-so,' and making subtle gestures in their direction, which got less and less subtle as she had more to drink. They were mainly men, I think, and to me they all looked old and unremarkable. Judging by her excitement, I imagine they were bigwigs in the film industry, important people. Then she said she was going to the bathroom. She was gone for some time, and I began to look about me, because I was bored. Suddenly I spotted her in the far corner, talking to a man. He was sitting, and there was another man opposite him, and my mother was crouching next to the table to speak to him. I could see, even from that distance, when things changed from being friendly, civil, to something else. She put her hand on his shoulder, and he reached up and removed it, very cool, not looking at her. Then she pointed right over at me, and his head came up, and his eyes met mine. I looked away quickly, down into my blanquette de veau. I know this may sound far-fetched, and I have no proof other than what I felt, but in that moment I knew that man was my father."
"Oh."
He took a long drink of his beer.
"When my mother came back to the table, I saw that her makeup was smeared. I think she'd been crying. Suddenly she appeared 10, 20 years older than she had before, and drunk. I wish she could have acknowledged that she felt as terrible as she looked. The pretense that we were still having fun was the worst. When she paid, she pulled the notes out of her purse, like this," he gestured with his free hand, "and threw them at the waiters, so they had to scrabble on the floor to pick them up. In the car, she forgot to put her driving shoes on at first, so she couldn't work out, when she put her high heel to the pedal, why it was so difficult to drive."
"She drove you home?"
"Yes, but she did try to be sensible. She asked me if I wanted to drive instead."
"She asked you?"
I tried not to sound as horrified as I felt.
"Yes."
He gave an odd smile.
"It's almost funny, when you think about it."
"It's lucky you didn't crash."
"Yes, although..."
"What?"
"I wonder now if that's what she wanted. I mean," he said quickly, "don't get me wrong, she definitely wouldn't have meant anything to happen to me. She probably hadn't thought it out to that extent. The following morning, I waited hours for her to get up. It was hot in the apartment. I was bored. I gathered all our beach things and sat watching the clock. When it was past midday, I finally went in to wake her up."
He didn't say anything else for a while. I couldn't think, though I tried, of something with which to fill the silence. In Nice, we took the TGV to Paris, crammed in with holidaymakers returning to Paris, sunburnt families and couples, bags haphazard about them. We just managed to find two seats amid the chaos. Much of my attention was caught by the warmth of Oliver's body, forced against mine on the small seat. Despite myself, I could not help but remark the beauty and size of the sun-browned hands resting in his lap, the curved, dexterous thumbs and elegant fingers. I pressed my head against the window and feigned sleep, watching the countryside rush past through half-closed eyes. When Oliver fell asleep, his head thrown back against the seat rest to expose the beautiful column of his throat, my sensitivity to his presence beside me waned. Now I was free to think about what lay ahead, all the possibility and terror of it. I thought about Stafford, too, making another journey all those years ago through a different France, returning from the front, both of us in search of the same woman. It was a balmy afternoon in Paris, a far cry from the scorched and salt-swept bluster of the Corsican climate that I had become accustomed to. As we stepped from the train at Gare de Lyon, I looked up at the station clock and found that it was only midday. There was time, I realized, with a stab of apprehension, to make my way across the city to call at the address. Echoing my thoughts, Oliver said,
"You could go straight there, I suppose."
"Oh," I said, wavering, suddenly drained of all confidence by the prospect. "I thought I'd drop off my bags first." I knew that it sounded feeble, a transparent play for time. When I glanced across at Oliver, I saw that he was studying me, and I looked away in case he read my cowardice in my face.
"Where will you stay?" he asked.
"I'll find a hotel." I'd already decided this. I still had most of the money Stafford had given me, which he had refused to take back. Oliver seemed to be making up his mind to speak.
"Or," he said, "you could stay at the apartment with me."
"I don't think so," I said too quickly. The idea scared me. But Oliver was tenacious.
"I know that Grandpère specifically wanted me to ask you."
I felt fatigue wash over me then. I was too tired to argue the point, I realized, too tired to trawl the city looking for somewhere to stay. The fact that it was Stafford's wish, not Oliver's, made it an easier offer to accept, made the gesture seem less significant. Oliver's apartment was above a cafe, of the sort that you see on old postcards of the city, with tables and chairs spilling across the pavement. Now it was rather subdued, a solitary couple having a quiet drink, but in the morning and during the lunchtime rush, Oliver said, you could faintly hear sounds drifting up through the floors, the thwack and screech of the coffee being made, the murmur of the customers sitting outside.
"I like it, though," he said. "I love staying with Grandpère, but I don't enjoy silence quite as much as him."
After the light and space of the Maison de Vent, the place seemed on the small side, though I'm sure that it was generous for the city. I could see, too, that it was rather beautiful, with tall windows leading onto a tiny ironwork balcony and toffee-coloured floorboards. A couple of twin Stafford sketches hung upon one wall, studies of the Maison de Vent from different approaches. There was an antique trunk that served as a coffee table and held a thick stack of architectural digests and a low-slung sofa. Yet these elements were far less noticeable than the sparseness that surrounded them. The place was shockingly bare, more like an elegant hotel room than a home. I saw that several cardboard boxes lined the corridor that ran between the rooms.
"I've been having a clear-out," Oliver said.
He didn't elaborate, and I didn't probe, not wanting to know whether any of them contained his wife's remaining possessions. It wasn't hard to understand why he had decided to escape to Corsica. I looked at him, standing there in his empty flat, and felt great pity for him. Whatever had happened between them, they must have loved each other once. The ending, however it had come about, had been a tragedy of sorts. No one entered a marriage anticipating its demise. He showed me to the spare room.
"It's not big," he said, "but hopefully it'll be comfortable."
When he disappeared, I sat down on the bed and regarded myself in the mirror opposite. I looked as tired and travel-worn as I felt, but there was something else, too, some barely perceptible change that couldn't be attributed to the colour I had managed to pick up. If it wasn't my imagination, I appeared more resolute, more certain of myself. I had begun to avoid looking in mirrors since Mum's death, because the girl I saw reflected in them was not someone I recognised. A spectre, a not-quite person. Now, however, I saw someone with purpose. Was this what Stafford had seen in me, that which I had not known until he had distilled it into the portrait? I returned to the sitting room where Oliver was waiting. It was odd. He looked awkward in the bare space, out of place, as though he were the guest. But then I recalled how I'd felt rattling around the house in Battersea, feeling like an imposter, a pale imitation of all that had been there before. Perhaps it wasn't so different for him. "Right," I said, and my voice sounded loud in the silence. "I should go now." Oliver shifted on his feet.
"I could walk you there, if you'd like. It would be quicker than you having to find your way."
I hoped, for the sake of my pride, that he could not see the relief on my face. When I showed him the address from the postcard, and he told me that it wasn't far, my heart began to beat faster. I had been so swept up in the events of the night before that I had almost managed to put it out of my mind. Now my trepidation came flooding back. In that moment, I think I might have preferred if he had told me that by some misunderstanding we'd ended up in the wrong city. Suddenly, I didn't feel ready. If I had thought I was the only one aware, and only newly aware, of Oliver's beauty, I discovered now that I was not. The sheer brazenness with which people looked at him surprised me. I noticed, even if he did not, the exquisite teenager who treated him to a sliding glance as she passed, the lingering gaze of the middle-aged woman arranging chairs outside a restaurant. Had I been so desensitized before that I had been unable to see something that was so obvious to everyone else? When we eventually came to stand in front of it, I couldn't quite believe that the house existed. The fact of it made it all real, made Alice real. Until this point, she had been like a figure from myth, and I had decided, from the off, to expect failure. I think I would have been less surprised to find that place had collapsed in a cloud of masonry and furniture into some yawning chasm in the ground. It seemed all too easy that I should be able to walk up to Alice's house and simply knock on the door. It was a beautiful building, soberly elegant, with a lofty grey stone frontage and a graceful symmetry of ironwork balconies through which ivy wended glossy dark stems.
"It's rare to own a whole house here," Oliver murmured. "She must be well off."
This sat oddly with what I thought I knew. Alice was the runaway, the girl who had forsaken a life of plenty for her freedom. I had imagined her scraping by, living a poor, bohemian existence in a grimy backwater. But this was unmistakably the address I'd copied down. Before I put my finger to the bell, I had what I can only describe as a funny turn. My head felt suddenly as though it were filled with helium. My vision swam and my heart beat a tattoo in my chest. As if sensing this, Oliver joined me on the step.
"I could come in with you," he said casually.
I looked at him, taken aback by his kindness. "Are you sure?"
"If you'd like," he shrugged offhandedly. "I don't have anywhere to be today."
"Okay," I said. "Yes, thank you." Gradually, I felt my breathing return to normal. My heart beat slow. I reached out and pressed the bronze button, once, hard. The door was opened by a woman in her 50s, with dark hair cropped close to her head and an austerely beautiful face. She was dressed simply, but not inexpensively, in a dark grey shift, with a necklace of gold filigree around her neck. She was one of those tiny, compact people, rather like my mother, in fact, who made me feel about 8 foot tall. I was suddenly aware of my elderly jeans and crumpled t-shirt. She looked from one to the other of us with a bird-bright assessing gaze.
"Oui?"
I explained, in my rusty but serviceable French, that we were looking for Alice.
"I don't understand."
She switched immediately and fluently into English, and I tried not to feel offended that she hadn't thought me up to the task of carrying out the discussion in her language.
"No one of that name lives here."
I know now that this ignorance was feigned, but that my use of the name had alarmed her into the pretense. But, then I remembered, I think she might also be known as Celia. She looked at me curiously and gave a shrug, as if implying it wasn't her problem if I were unhinged.
"All right, what is it that you want?"
I tried to remind myself that it was probably the fact that she was not speaking in her own tongue that made her sound so cold. "It's rather difficult to explain."
"Well, she isn't available at the moment."
I saw that she had a firm grip on the door, as if she were preparing to fling it shut in our faces. "She lives here, though." This woman had already told me much more than she might have imagined. Alice was alive. A curt nod.
"This is her house."
She began to close the door.
"I'm sorry, but I
need to speak to her." I hadn't meant to raise my voice, but it was almost a shout. She raised her eyebrows, but her hand on the door stilled, and I lowered my voice. "I should introduce myself. My name is Kate." I put out my hand, and she stared at it for a moment before taking it, reluctantly.
"Marguerite."
"Would you... I don't mean to impose, but I know that Celia will want to meet me. It's about something very important." Then I added, as an afterthought, "as important to her as it is to me, I think." Marguerite shifted in the doorway, apparently wrong-footed. I tried to peer past her down the length of the dark hallway, as though Alice might be waiting somewhere within, ready to receive me if I passed this first trial. Perhaps I could call on her later. Or tomorrow?
Marguerite looked puzzled, then turned and followed my gaze into the depths of the house. She shook her head and gave a funny sort of laugh.
Oh, no, she said. No, she isn't here. Not in Paris.
I'm sorry, I don't follow. I understood this was her house. The thought came to me then. Perhaps she was dead after all. And this woman was playing a nasty little game to test the validity of my story.
So where?
New York.
New York? I echoed faintly.
She has a gallery there. One here and one over there, in New York. This is still her house, too, naturally. When she is away, I look after it.
She inclined her head.
She spends more and more time there now.
She smiled economically.
So, you see, you will have to come some other time.
She waved a hand.
A month, perhaps. I think she will return in November, for the opening of the new exhibition.
November? It can't wait until November. I tried to calm myself. It's very important that I speak to her now.
She looked unmoved.
What can it be that you need to see her so urgently?
I can't explain properly here.
Marguerite shrugged, as though she didn't believe it would do any good, but couldn't summon the energy to argue the point with me.
All right, you can come in.
She beckoned briskly, bidding us follow her into the house. The corridor that led from the front door was lined with artwork. I tried to take stock of the pieces, but Marguerite moved too quickly and glanced round a couple of times as if to see what was taking us so long. As we reached the end of the hallway, Oliver touched my arm and drew me back. It was all I could do to avoid remarking how my skin thrilled at the warmth of his touch.
Look.
It was an abstract, fierce squares of black and white, among which wandered bent humanoid figures. In one corner was a red cross, daubed in a quick, careless gesture, so that the paint had run from the lines to bleed down towards the bottom of the canvas. It was intriguing, certainly, but I couldn't understand why Oliver had drawn my attention to it.
It's my grandfather's, one of his pieces on the wall.
Now I stared. It was so different from anything I had seen of Stafford's, so much more raw and violent.
And there's another, one of his odalisques.
I turned to see a hugely fat woman splayed on a sofa wearing nothing but a bath towel wrapped around her head, one hand dangling indolently, the fingers beautifully done. There was, despite her unhealthy size, something oddly arresting about her, a beauty that had been drawn out in the portrayal, in the delicate bluish pallor of her lolling breasts, the proud white meringue of her stomach. It was curious, to say the least, that these two works should be in Alice's possession. Perhaps they had been presents. But then I saw that the odalisk was dated 1962, and Stafford had told me that he had last seen Alice in the 30s. So, it seemed, Alice was a collector of his work. Did Stafford know? I felt sure that he would have mentioned it if he had. Oliver had spotted another painting he recognized before Marguerite came out of the kitchen to check why we had been delayed.
Is there a problem?
No, said Oliver, apparently not inclined to say anything else.
Then he changed his mind and added,
Actually, I stopped to look at the art.
Marguerite regarded us steadily, apparently trying to decide whether we were pulling her leg or planning to steal one of the pieces.
Oh, yes?
Yes, I noticed, Oliver gestured to them. A couple of works here I recognize. They're my grandfather's.
They are?
She stopped, wrong-footed.
Your grandfather is Thomas Stafford?
Yes.
She looked from one to the other of us, incredulous.
But Celia is probably the largest collector of his work in the world.
It was surreal, being in Alice's house without actually having come close to meeting her. Perhaps it was my imagination. But to me, the air in the building felt rarefied, charged with some essence of the absent woman. There was the faintest savour of something smoky and exotic in the air that it seemed to rise up in a cloud from the cushions when we sat upon them. We were at the back of the house. The light filtered green into the room from the small garden beyond the windows, and the topmost shoots of a white rosebush scratched against the glass with a tiny sound.
A Burmese cat padded past on silent paws and slinked up the staircase, uninterested in our presence. Oliver and I sat on a low, emerald-coloured ottoman with claws for feet, and Marguerite sat in a chair opposite, slightly elevated above us. I cradled my bowl of coffee in my lap, trying not to spill it. It felt like the start of an interrogation. "So," I said to break the silence, "how do you know Celia?" Marguerite took her time answering.
"I've known her for a long while," she said finally. "Nearly all my life."
"Huh. No relation, then." I waited for an elaboration on this, but none was forthcoming.
"And how do you know her?"
It was spoken like a challenge. "Actually, I don't know her. Not exactly." She raised an eyebrow, perhaps wondering if she had made a mistake in admitting us. I hastened on. "But I'm her granddaughter. My mother was her daughter, June Darling." I had expected Marguerite's reaction to be one of incredulity, or worse, outrage. I read neither in her expression. If anything, it had softened.
"So you are Kate," she studied me.
"Yes, you look like the photos I have seen of your mother. A little like Celia, I think."
"Thank you. But how—"
"Celia has known about you for a long time," she said, answering before I could ask. "I want to say that I am sorry for your loss. Your mother was a wonderful dancer. I saw her once in Swan Lake."
"Thank you," I said, thrown by this compassion from a woman who had seemed so cold only moments before.
"When your mother died, Celia was nearly destroyed by grief. It was the great tragedy of her life, that she never knew her."
"But she left her." I failed to keep the censure from my voice. Marguerite looked fierce. She leaned closer, until I worried she might be about to pour her coffee into my lap.
"Let me tell you something. I don't know exactly what happened. Celia has never told me. But she would not have left your mother unless she had no choice. That is not the sort of woman she is."
She sat back and regarded me with those bright black eyes. Perhaps she felt she hadn't gone far enough towards convincing me, because she went on in a rush.
"I was so jealous of your mother. Of how much Celia wanted to make contact with her, how much she longed for her."
She stopped quickly, as though she had surprised herself with the confession. There was a weighted silence, punctuated only by the faraway retort of a car horn. Suddenly, Oliver spoke.
"Will you let Celia know that Kate will be coming to visit her? This week, if possible."
"Oliver!" I turned to look at him, wondering what his game was, but he simply gazed back at me, impassively, as though it had all been planned in advance. To my surprise, Marguerite was nodding her head.
"Yes," she said. "Yes, I think that would be best."
Outside in the street, Oliver seemed possessed of an unusual energy.
"We need to get there before they shut," he said.
"Where?"
"The travel agents."
We walked back along the Rue de Seine and onto the grimy thoroughfare of the Boulevard Saint-Germain. As soon as we found one, Oliver strode in and asked at the desk for a ticket to New York and a flight back to London Heathrow. A stone of melancholy dropped through me at the thought of home, the place that now seemed so bound up with loneliness and grief. He hadn't suggested, I realized, that I might prefer to return to Paris. Within minutes, I was booked on the morning flight from Charles de Gaulle to JFK. I saw Oliver fish his wallet from his pocket and suddenly realized what he meant to do. "No," I said in alarm as he took out his card. "I can't let you." He turned to me.
"I want to," he said firmly. "I told you before that I wanted to help, and it seems I found a way to do so."
"I know," I said, "but not like this. It's too much." But as I looked at him, I could see how adamant he was, for whatever reasons of his own, that he would do this thing. So, still wondering at it, I let him. By the time he made it back to the apartment, dusk was falling, spilling its purplish shadow across the city. The streets were busy, the tables outside bars crowded with people. Oliver told me that only a few weeks ago many of the bars would have been shut, the city eerily quiet.
"I imagine you hardly ever see it like that," I said, "having always gone down to Corsica in the summer."
"No, that's true. I'd never really known it until recently.
So you stayed here one summer? He made a kind of grimace, and I suddenly regretted asking him.
Yes. For 4 years, actually. Isabel didn't like to travel a lot. Well, not at all, to be honest. So we stayed here.
Ah. I couldn't think of anything else to say. I had felt the name Isabel like a sting. At the apartment, I had a shower, hurrying from the bathroom to my room so I could avoid an awkward meeting with Oliver in the hallway. I changed my clothes, feeling the need for an outfit altogether more elegant than the jeans and t-shirt, now distinctly off-white, that I'd worn to travel in. I picked through my clothes indecisively, wishing I had something truly beautiful to wear. It was the city, I told myself, doing this to me. I turned my bag upside down, prepared to be disappointed by what was in there. To my amazement, beneath the faded shorts and t-shirts stained with sun cream, was my black crepe-de-chine dress, the one I had worn on my 21st birthday. I had not seen it since then. It must simply have been hidden in plain sight in my wardrobe, and I had somehow managed to sweep it up with my other things. I had certainly been distracted when I had packed for Corsica. Even so, I felt a thrill go through me. It was perfect, cut high at the neck, sleeveless, close-fitting. I had forgotten how I felt transformed wearing it, several degrees more elegant. As I studied myself in the mirror, I realized why I had always loved it so much, because it made me look a little like her, like Mum. I heard Oliver's footsteps then, approaching my door.
"Would you prefer to go out for supper?" he asked. "Or we could eat here?"
I thought. I was dog-tired, but I hadn't been in Paris since I'd visited as a girl with Mum. Besides, a crowded restaurant would be infinitely preferable to an awkward supper à deux in this empty flat. I could not help but suspect that Oliver's cupboards would have nothing in them. I did not want him to have to humiliate himself by admitting it, to have to reveal to me how he had been living before he came to Corsica. The restaurant was crammed with diners and dimly lit, clamorous with music and chatter. We were shown to a table in one of the shadowy alcoves that lined one brick wall. Its removal from the central chaos lent it a peculiar intimacy. It was a space intended for lovers, I realized. While Oliver was speaking to our waiter, I studied him. The candlelight acted upon his features, drenched the hollows in shadow, illuminated the sharp crests of cheekbone and brow. What was revealed was an almost terrible, unearthly beauty. Then he turned to me and gave a cautious smile, and became himself again. Still, I thought, how could I have been indifferent to such a face? We asked for a bottle of wine, and drank it as we studied the menu. On my empty stomach, the alcohol went to work quickly, and I began to feel a pleasant haziness descend. With each glass, the restaurant around me became incrementally less real, fading gradually to an assemblage of light and noise and colour, of sensation and impression. Finally, a waiter freed himself from the melee and came to take our orders.
"So," Oliver said when he had gone, "New York?"
"Yes." I felt my stomach twist with a sudden rush of apprehension.
"Have you been before?"
"Once," I said, "with Mum, though I can barely remember it. I was only a kid. Have you?"
"Yes," he said, "only once."
"When?"
"Oh," he said vaguely, "quite recently, a couple of years ago."
Immediately, I understood what this meant. He had been there with her. Perhaps the alcohol was to blame for my tactlessness, but suddenly, inevitably, I had to ask. "Tell me about your wife. About Isabel." Speaking her name felt like uttering an incantation, one that could wreak untold results.
"Oh," he said warily, "you don't want to hear any of that."
"Yes, I do," I told him. "I want to know." Most of me didn't. Most of me cringed from it. And, judging by his expression, I was certain that he didn't want to talk about her. Yet it seemed important now that I should hear it all. Our food arrived then, and Oliver looked relieved. I wondered if he hoped it might distract me from the train of our conversation, but when the waiter had disappeared once more, I waited for him to continue. He took a long sip of his wine.
"She was one of the other students on my course. She was extremely talented, full of ideas. We all thought she would be the star graduate. I was mesmerized by her, he said. At least to begin with.
I tried not to hate her. Isabel was manic depressive. Oliver didn't find out until they had moved in together after a few months, and he discovered her lithium hidden in an aspirin box.
Before I lived with her, I think I only saw the mania. Although she didn't seem manic exactly, merely alive, spontaneous. It was exciting. I'd never met anyone like her. I didn't see the bad times, though I did think it odd that sometimes she wouldn't surface for days.
I thought of a student on my course whom I'd learned had the same condition. Because I hadn't known him well, I too had only been aware of one side of things. The city-wide treasure hunts he organized, the all-night parties he held in disused warehouses. How could you not become infatuated by someone who seemed to radiate such vitality? Half the student body had been a little in love with him, though there were also weeks when he wouldn't appear at a single class, and rumors of a failed suicide attempt. Oliver took another long sip of wine, nearly draining the glass. Immediately, the waiter hurried to top it up.
Then her work started to suffer. She had all these ideas, all this imagination, but she couldn't channel it into her work. Architecture is creative, but it is also extremely practical, and she couldn't marry the two. She stopped taking her lithium because she thought it was stifling her. She became jealous of my work and of me in general, who I was seeing, why I wasn't spending more time with her. I felt guilty when I wasn't with her too, because I knew she was fragile.
He paused.
I thought that I would be able to help her, to make her better. I thought that loving her would be enough.
He stopped. It wasn't, I ventured.
No. There was one evening when I got home and I found her.
He swallowed.
Anyway, they said it would never have been enough to kill her.
With a shock, I realized what he meant. Immediately, I remembered the picture he had painted, of a small boy discovering his lifeless mother.
I started drinking too much, he went on. In that last year, I wasn't sober often, in fact. I hoped it would make me care less, and it did for a while. Ultimately, though, it made me hate myself more, for being so weak, for coping in the same way my mother had done.
Did you leave her?
No. In the end, she left me. She'd been sleeping with a friend of her parents. It caused quite a scandal when it all came out. He's a politician and much older than her. I learned about it the same way everyone else did, in a French tabloid.
He plunged on, as if afraid of stopping.
I got drunk. I drank so much that, looking back, I was lucky to wake up in the morning. The next day I got on a train and turned up in Corsica without any warning. Grandpère was wonderful about it.
There was a long pause, then I steeled myself to ask it. Are you still in love with her? He shook his head.
No. I wonder now if I ever was, though I thought I loved her in the beginning.
He sighed.
In a way, when I found out that she'd been cheating, it sounds terrible, but I was relieved more than anything. She'd made the break that I'd been too scared to, because I'd been so worried about how it might affect her. She's getting married again, I heard.
To him? The politician?
Yes. Perhaps he'll be better for her than I was. Maybe she needs someone older, someone stricter. I don't know.
He looked drained for a second, as though the telling of all of it had cost him a great effort.
So,
Oliver said, as we walked away from the restaurant,
have you ever been in love?
For a moment I considered it, recalling the only two half-serious boyfriends I'd had, Charlie and the one other who came before him. No, I said. I don't believe so. Sometimes, I groped for the words through the fug of wine, sometimes I think I never will, that I'll always be alone. I wonder if that's how I'm meant to be. Oliver gave a half smile at this.
Oh, Kate, he said quietly. I may have managed to make a disaster of it so far, but even I know that no one's meant to be alone, least of all someone like you.
As we wound our way through the dark streets, a thought struck me. Are we near the river?
Not far. Why?
I hesitated, feeling foolish. When I came here with my mother, I explained, she took me down to the river to see how it looked at night, with all the lights.
Okay, he said. Let's go there.
He was kind, I thought then. Coming to the house with me, booking the flight, and now this. It was so strange to think of how afraid I had been of him during those first few days in Corsica. Then again, he was different now. He too had undergone some sort of transformation. We wandered through the old streets of the district, past the shadowy shops with their grills pulled down, and the odd bar bleeding music and talk into the night air. Then we were at the river. It was as I had remembered. The black water, the alchemical rush of gold beneath the surface. Across the river was the left bank, but before that was the glittering giant of the Île Saint-Louis. As a girl it had seemed an incredible place to me, an enchanted island that might at any moment uproot and sail downstream. Perhaps a little of that magic, unique to childhood, had faded, but as if in compensation the lights were multiplied tenfold by a mist of tears. Thank you, I said to Oliver. He turned to look at me.
Are you okay?
Yes, I said. I'm fine. He looked away, understanding.
She sounds wonderful, Oliver said, as we were making our way back to the apartment.
I nodded. I wish I could be more like her.
In what way?
She was so brave.
But I think you are too. What you're doing here in Paris, that is brave.
And then he said,
I'm sure she had her flaws too.
At first, I was outraged. How dare he say that of her? Mum hadn't any flaws. She had been more than a mother to me. She had been a best friend. Friends at school had told me how envious they were of this. She was chic in a way that other mothers weren't, and generous too. On my 16th birthday, she had rented a room at the Groucho Club, and we had sat at a candlelit table and eaten grown-up food. Fillet steak and Dauphinoise potatoes, and drunk champagne. Then, in a flash, I thought of Mum missing Parents' Evening year after year because it clashed with performance dates and the time she'd forgotten to collect me from my geography field trip because a rehearsal had overrun. Those weren't flaws, though, surely. That was simply being busy. Still, the strangest thing, some part of me found it reassuring. Back in the flat, Oliver asked if I wanted a digestif before going to bed. I hesitated. I was tired, and more than a little drunk, but also very awake. My mind was alive with this somewhat altered image of Mum that he had provoked, an image at once disturbing and strangely comforting. I sat down in his bare sitting room while he found a bottle of wine and two glasses, then came to sit beside me, closer than he might have done, I suspected, had he been completely sober.
I've had too much to drink now, he said, echoing my thoughts, and paused, as though he were finding his next words. But there's something I want to tell you, Kate.
He'd been swaying slightly earlier as we walked back, but his gaze now was intent, absolutely focused. Okay, I suddenly felt quite sober.
Well, he said, I think you're great.
Oh. Thank you. It struck me that great was possibly the blandest epithet he could have used.
No, he said as if realizing this, not great. I'm not thinking properly. What I mean is that you're different. In the best way, he hastened to add. You're quiet, but you aren't shy. And you're watchful.
There it was, that word again.
You see things differently. You understand them in a way most people don't. Am I making any sense?
I think so, I told him, though I wasn't entirely sure.
What I mean, he went on, enunciating carefully, is that I couldn't believe I'd told you. A stranger. All of those things. Things I haven't even spoken to Grandpère about. I've been thinking about it, and I've come to the conclusion it's because of, well, how you are.
Oh, I said again.
I'm sorry I followed you to Paris, he said.
Is that what you were doing? He nodded, and I felt a thrill go through me. Why did you? I asked, as lightly as I could.
I don't know.
He took a deep breath, let it out unsteadily.
No, I do. I couldn't help myself. I sensed from the beginning that it was a bad idea to spend too much time near you.
He shrugged.
Once I knew about your mother, I understood that you must be suffering, and I, well, you know now what a disaster my life has been, and yet I don't seem to be able to leave you alone.
Oh.
I think I knew, he said slowly, right from the start, when I picked you up at the airport.
No, I told him. No, you didn't. You were horrible to me.
That's exactly it, he said. It was the only thing I could do.
He put down his glass, and I could feel his eyes on me. Possibility was there in the room with us now. Thrilling, tangible, dangerous.
Look at me, Kate, he said quietly.
So I did, and found he was now very near to me. So close, in fact, that I saw for the first time a faint trail of freckles across his nose, and noticed the extraordinary length of the dark lashes that should have been feminine but were somehow absolutely not. His gaze dropped to my mouth, and I felt the pressure of it there upon my skin. I don't think, I said unsteadily, this is a good idea. But even as I spoke, I hoped he would prove me wrong. Oliver nodded.
I know, he said. It's a terrible idea.
He didn't move any further away.
And yet, his gaze still on my mouth, I don't seem to be able to do anything about it.
The moment stretched to an unbearable tautness, and he moved even closer, the spice of the wine on his breath intoxicating as any drug. Then something in me snapped. He had just told me about his divorce, for God's sake. We were surrounded by evidence of it, the misery symbolically present in the boxes of possessions that lined the hallway. With a great, wrenching effort of willpower, I put down my glass and stood up. I think I should say goodnight, I said, but thank you for today. I walked unsteadily down the corridor to my bedroom, moving with the slow, difficult steps of someone drugged. This was the only way it could be, I told myself, trying to think clearly. Anything else would be disastrous. As I closed the door behind me, I heard his footsteps. Despite myself, I felt a leap of pure exhilaration in my chest. I opened the door a fraction and looked at him. He was lit from behind, his face in darkness.
Kate, he said, and his voice was hoarse. Please.
Then he was pushing the door, and his mouth was on mine. That first taste, so long in coming, was unutterably sweet. We fell back together into the room, and this time I knew there would be no stopping. I remember that I thought, rather matter-of-factly, there's nothing to be done about it. After that, I don't recall thinking much at all. When I woke, Oliver was nowhere to be seen, and neither was the pile of clothes that he had shed the night before. Only my black dress, coiled there like a spilled slick of oil on the floorboards. For a moment I wondered if I had imagined it all. It seemed even stranger and less plausible in the light of day than it had in the small hours, as I had waited to fall asleep. But no, I could make out the distinct imprint of where he had lain beside me. There was the way my body felt, too, the pleasurable ache, the faintest trace of his scent. There was even the faint pink reminder of his stubble against my collarbone, where he had kissed and gently bitten the skin there. We ate breakfast together in the cafe beneath his apartment, and we were awkward with one another, overly polite, and then, when my taxi came, unsure of how to go about the business of saying goodbye. I wasn't stupid. I think we both knew that it couldn't be easy between us, that there was no way of telling what would come of it. In many ways, what had happened was the exact thing I had feared, what I had been guarding myself against in the months since Mum's death. In my defense, it had taken me utterly by surprise, had ambushed me when I had been least expecting it. This was what happened, I thought, when you let someone be on the barrier you had set up. You opened up the possibility for pain. Yet, despite my fears, I could not make myself regret it, because I had not felt that close to being happy in a long time.